Session number 13253, Jim Forrest, Reel 2.
Jim Forrest, Reel 2.
Says, I was very much appreciated in my work. I did my work quite well with great enthusiasm. I don't think that any criticisms I had of the government were interfering with the quality of my work. I respected and in many cases admired the people I was working with. The captain was a bit of a nutter, but the executive officer was a remarkable man, a fine man. And several of the other people I worked with were people of outstanding qualities. I was told by the commanding officer that the Central Intelligence Agency wanted to talk with me. Whether that was the next day or 2 days later, I don't know. But I was sent over to this NIS headquarters in Washington, D.C., which is on the Potomac River. And there interviewed at length through much of a day by two officers in civilian clothes. It was the typical, as I now realize, interviewing method of the hostile and friendly interviewer. Very scary, absolute terrifying experience. So threatening. The basic message was that either I should cooperate with them or go to prison. And I took cooperation to mean, I think it was made pretty clear. Be interesting to hear the tapes. They're probably someplace in some archive, someplace in Washington, D.C., because it was all a big tape recorder with wheels turning. And there was an interrogation room that had one of these double panes of glass, mirrors that were obviously there not for combing your hair by, but for watching people through the other side. So there might have been other people watching besides the two who were in the room. It's impossible to know. In any event, it would be interesting to hear the tapes. Now, it was clear to me that I was being given the alternative of becoming possibly a spy or something like that. They might have assigned me to become very active in the peace movement, you see. I could have spent my life working for the peace movement on their behalf very easily, or part of it, or going to prison. Well, it was very clear to me that if those were the choices, it would certainly be prison. And I was suddenly, for the first time perhaps, deeply grateful that my father had been to prison, because I knew that you could go through that, because he'd gone through it. And he'd come out with wonderful stories. I remember particularly his stories about the priest, the Catholic priest who was the chaplain, and how kind he was to my father when he was in prison. And many stories about prisoners and so forth. He didn't come out with a lot of frightening stories that you might have heard from other people, but he always saw the human side of things and the human qualities, and was more interested in the good people than the bad people. So that all somehow very abruptly made it easier to make a choice, I think. Or probably would have made it even if my father had never been to prison, but I think it made it a good deal easier to stand by my conscience, you could say. They had, of course, you can see it from their side also, it must have been a very strange business. Here's the son of a communist, claims that he's a Christian, that his motivation for being in this protest at the CIA is religious. Well, this, you might as well have talked about flying to the moon or something. This is totally, I can imagine from their point of view, ludicrous. So it's very likely that from their point of view, I was somebody who was a very suspicious character indeed. You know, how could I not be? Oldest son of a notorious communist picketing the CIA. Well, whatever you want to make of their point of view, and whatever I can remember of mine after all these years, it was the day in which it became clear to me that I could no longer continue in the Navy. Up to that point, I was quite willing to do my work and to do it well, right to the last day. And I had voluntarily enlisted, and I had my job to do. There was nothing in the job which per se violated any moral code that I held dear. If it was a bit of a waste of time compared to things I might be doing, well, that was too bad. I just had to wait. But then I realized I couldn't go on any longer. And I just said to them at the end of the day, I realize that I am a pacifist, I am a conscientious objector, and that I really think the only alternative at this point is whatever else happens to me, that I should be discharged. If you want to send me to prison first, well, then you have to do that. But there will come a point in the near future where if you don't give me a discharge, I will stop cooperating. I will not, in other words, I won't continue to fulfill orders, do my work, etc. Then you'll have to send me to prison. Because I cannot do things which I cannot agree to do what you're asking me to do. I don't think they were expecting this. I don't know what I would have expected either. I have in my archives at home in a trunk of papers some of the things having to do with these times, forms that answers that I gave, a statement that I wrote for them that day, and so forth. Well, to make a long story short, I received a great deal of support unexpectedly from people in the Navy. I expected quite the opposite. Not from my commanding officer, who considered me a traitor, but from my executive officer, who probably lost a stripe on his uniform that he would have gotten later that year by supporting me wholeheartedly. I remember him coming up to me in the office and say, "Forrest, you know, I was in the seminary." He was a Catholic. "I was in the seminary for, I don't know how many years, 6 years, 5 years. I never heard anything about conscientious objection. How could you possibly be a conscientious objector and a Catholic?" And luckily, Carl Meyer, who had been on this vigil, had given me the name of a priest at Catholic University who was a pacifist, Father Robert Havde. And I had been over to see Father Havde, and he'd given me a book written by a Dominican named Father Franciscus Stratmann. Man who'd been condemned to death by Hitler's government but managed to live in hiding and survive the war. Famous theologian. Called War and Christianity Today. Little tiny book. And I read it, and I still had it, and I gave it to my executive officer. And the next day, he came into the cafeteria with a broad smile and came up to me with great gusto, shook my hand vigorously. And I can remember him saying, "Forrest, I'm proud of you. You're doing the right thing." Well, that I can't tell you how much that meant to me. And there were various others who also, in their own ways, gave meaningful support. Few didn't. Few were quite hostile. But generally, everybody, to my relief and amazement, knew that I was sincere, knew that I was a very highly motivated sort of person, and whether I was right or not, they respected me. Took a little while, but with the chaplain in my particular base gave me his support, not quite clearly understanding the whole thing, but he knew a little bit about the Catholic worker movement. He'd once met Peter Morin, co-founder of Cisco. You know, the psychiatrist that I was sent to at the Pentagon recommended that I be discharged as expeditiously as possible. There were various things that happened, and I didn't go to prison, and I was given a general discharge. I should have gotten an honorable discharge, because I had absolutely nothing. I was charged with no crimes, and I had committed no crimes. I had done nothing, absolutely nothing, which would have justified objectively a general discharge rather than honorable, but I was very happy to get any kind of discharge at all. And went up to New York City and joined the Catholic Worker.
So. Yeah. I was going to ask you, what sort of connection you had with peace groups at this time. You know, these people, for instance, who had formed the vigil, did you make connections with them?
Well, it is, as you know, it's always hard after so many years to get all the pieces in the right order. I was certainly aware about Quakers. I remember having met somebody who was a Quaker when I was in high school and thinking about the points that were raised by them. Oh, sorry.
There are tornadoes, but it's overcast, isn't it?
Yeah.
He's perhaps you could repeat.
Reminds me of being in Israel, and very frequently these planes flying over and crashing noises coming down. It's deafening, much louder than that. They're much lower flights than this flyby.
But you were saying about the Quakers, weren't you?
Well, I remember being impressed a bit and coming home from high school one day, having had a visitor, perhaps from the American Friends Service Committee, speaking to some student group. I don't remember exactly what it was all about, but it raised the issue of conscientious objection. I remember coming home and talking to my father that evening about conscientious objection. He absolutely disagreed with that, and in a very low-key, rational way, explained that he didn't think that that was made any sense. And I didn't work it out one way or the other in my mind. I remember thinking that the Quaker was a rather nice person, and I had a great deal of respect for my father, even though I didn't always agree with him. And I just left it on hold. Obviously, it wasn't on my mind at all when I joined the Navy. It didn't occur to me as a question, you know. I can remember visiting the Quaker Meeting House in Washington during that period. Indeed, it was because I think that how I knew about this, I don't know, but that there was going to be somebody coming to the Quaker Meeting House who came from a group called the Central Committee for Conscientious Objectors. And this happened to be at just this time. Just this time. I was right in the midst of all this stuff. And I had, I think maybe a day or two before, had been this interview with the Naval Intelligence Service, and then here he was. Now, how I discovered this, I can't remember. Maybe somebody involved in this vigil had put me in touch with some group in Washington, or somehow I went to the Quaker Meeting House, heard him give a little talk. His name was George Willoughby. Afterward, came up and introduced myself to him, said I was in the Navy and that I was a conscientious objector and I was hoping I'd be able to get a discharge. And he said, well, there are regulations in the military and in the Navy for the discharge of conscientious objectors. Well, I didn't know that. So I was able to take the Bureau of Naval Personnel manual, which I knew, which used to sit on my desk when I was working in the front office, and find this stuff, and there it was. So it was an actual basis for being discharged. That was a great discovery, and it was thanks to him. And I still probably have some of the letters that he wrote to me during those months. So there was that contact. And I was going up to the Catholic Worker in New York occasionally to visit on weekends or whatever, when I had little spaces in my work schedule.
What sort of organization was that? Catholic,
well, I think what drew me to it wasn't the fact that it was a Catholic pacifist organization, although it was, but I was very moved by Dorothy Day, the founder of Dorothy Day's autobiography, which I'd found in a book rack in one of the churches where I went to Mass sometimes in Washington. There was a nice series of Catholic books that was being published by Doubleday in America, image paperbacks that were Catholic books of great merit, many of them by English authors, G.K. Chesterton, Ronald Knox, people of great merit from the English Catholic Church who were very influential, as it turned out, in America as well, sometimes more influential in America than in England. Dorothy Day's book was among the series of books that there were in this series, and I was struck by the title, The Long Loneliness, picked it up, read it, and Dorothy turned out to be a woman whom I could identify with for more reasons than one, because she'd also come from the left, and she had found her way to the Catholic Church. She had worked for socialist newspapers, and she'd been in prison as a suffragette during just before World War I, and she had indeed, she had actually known some people that my father and mother knew, you see. She was a bit older than they were, but there were lines of coincidence. She knew Elizabeth Gurley Flynn. Well, I had met Elizabeth Gurley Flynn in my home. She was the head of the American Communist Party. So there were all these things. Anyway, I went up to visit the Catholic Worker, met Dorothy Day, was very impressed by her. And what were they doing? It was running a house of hospitality on the Lower East Side of New York, near the Bowery, which was at that time an extremely poor, desperately poor section with lots of alcoholics, people sleeping rough on the streets, extremely poor Puerto Rican families, all sorts of lost souls, you could say. And the Catholic worker ran a soup kitchen, clothing room, had a decrepit old television sitting someplace where people could sit and watch the TV, and the House of Hospitality, of which there, thank God, are a great many in this world. This was the first one I'd ever been in. And I was just delighted to discover such a place and such interesting people. Very interesting. So it seemed almost the only place to go, really, when I left the Navy. It was Catholic. I was Catholic. It was doing work that was sometimes a matter of life and death for people. And they were very happy for me to come up, and they found a place for me to stay. Slept on the floor for a while, on a mattress on the floor in some tenement. Well, at that age, those kinds of things don't bother you a bit.
How about the relationship of this with Pax Christi? How did that...
Well, you see, there was no Pax Christi in America at that time. And that was one of the things that I became very interested in, you see. We were in touch with a group in England called Pax. Well, as I told you early on, I always had a great love of typography. And Pax had a very beautiful newsletter printed in Eric Gill's Perpetua Type. And I can remember being very struck by it. I didn't even know it was one of Gill's typefaces, I don't think. Maybe I did by that time, probably did. But I was for some reason, people have different sensitivities. I've always been very sensitive to type. And so I was very happy to be reading this publication of English pacifists who were Catholic. And there was no group like that. The closest thing to it was the United States Catholic Worker Movement. So it seemed to me we ought to have something like that in America. Then I remember getting a letter from the Secretary for Church Work of the Fellowship of Reconciliation saying that there ought to be a Catholic Peace Fellowship. Now, the FOR in America had a number of peace fellowships. There were Methodist peace fellowships and Baptist peace fellowships, and I don't remember all the different ones. There were quite a number. There was no Catholic peace fellowship, and there were very, very few Catholics who belonged to the FOR. I knew that there was the FOR, but I wasn't a member either. And it was seen and perceived practically by anybody who knew about it as a Protestant organization. But John was a very special man. I remember him coming into New York City to take me out to have a meal someplace. We went to a Jewish restaurant on the Lower East Side, very nice place that I've always enjoyed going to. Had a kosher meal and talked about founding a Catholic Peace Fellowship. That took hold of me. What we found out very quickly was that all the Catholics who were interested in forming a specifically pacifist Catholic peace group, naturally they all had connection of some sort with a Catholic worker, were not at all well disposed to being part of an organization that was largely pacifist, Protestant. That was still the time when the borderline between Christianity, within the borders within Christianity and between Catholics and Protestants, was at least as formidable as the Berlin Wall. You know, it's hard to remember now. Times have changed so much. But that was a very wide border between these two sections of Christianity. But they took to the idea perhaps it could be an American Pax Society. And that was how Pax was founded in America. And then Pax in time became Pax Christi, USA. It took some years. So it grew out of the Catholic Worker.
I suppose the next big event would have been the Vietnam War, wouldn't it? To have sort of impinged on you at that time in the 1960s.
Yes.
Yes. Did that sort of coincide with the sort of development of Pax Christi and your activity, would you say?
No, it preceded the Vietnam War. Let's see. This would have been 61, 62. What was most on our minds at that time, on the one hand, domestically, was racism, civil rights movement, Martin Luther King, things like that. The Montgomery bus boycott was perhaps happening at that time, or had happened not long before. Important events were taking place in challenging racism in America, and we were very sensitive to that. But on the other hand, we were very concerned about nuclear weapons. Once a week, the Catholic Worker people, those who were interested, would go up to the Civil Defense Headquarters, I think it was on Madison Avenue or Lexington Avenue in Manhattan, and hand out leaflets. And that was the second or third demonstration that I became associated with. I can't remember whether I was picketing Woolworths, which is part of the civil rights movement. At that time, we were protesting segregated lunch counters in Woolworth stores in the American South, or whether these things happened at this more or less the same time. So there were some picket lines in front of Woolworths, and there was not a picket line, but just handing out leaflets near the Civil Defense Headquarters and saying, in effect, that if there is a nuclear war, don't kid yourself, getting under your school desk or going into the subway isn't going to have much influence on what happens to you and to your family and to this country. It's going to be a Holocaust. I can't remember when Vietnam first really pushed itself as a subject into my mind, but it was probably in 64, by which time I was working for a New York City daily newspaper, you see. So that was a while to come. I got arrested during the time I was at the Catholic Worker for sitting in front of the Central, not the Central Intelligence Agency, what was it? It was the Atomic Energy Commission, the AEC, had one of its office buildings in Manhattan on Hudson Street, and I was one of the principal organizers of sit-in at the entrances to protest the resumption of nuclear testing in the atmosphere by the United States government. You see, there had been a moratorium that Khrushchev and Kennedy had agreed to, and then I think Khrushchev broke the moratorium first, and the United States then broke its moratorium, and we decided that we would protest by sitting in front of the entranceway. And there's quite a spectacular photograph of me being carried away from by the police that was on the front page of several newspapers. I don't have it myself, but I remember seeing it at the time. I'd just come up from a stay with Thomas Merton at the Abbey of Gethsemane, and the monks had given me quite a short haircut, so the photographers thought I was rather an interesting sight, with this practically bald head and smiling face being carried away. Well, it was probably something to see. I was just a little boy at the time. 20 years old or something like that. I was in prison for a little while. You know, first in what was called the Tombs, the Manhattan jail, and then out on Hart's Island for about a month as a ringleader of this sit down.
So, what was that like, your prison experience?
Well, I had a rather good time. I've enjoyed most of my prison experiences, I must say. I don't know if I would these days. I think the prisons have become quite a bit worse, at least in America. On the other hand, so much has to do with your own attitude. And I guess, again, I would have to say there was a certain debt to my father. He had given me an example of somebody who had looked for what was good in any situation. And I knew, having grown up in rather poor circumstances, that you needn't be afraid of poor people, it's mainly poor people who are in prison, of course, almost entirely, 90% at least, who've had rather sad lives and difficulties and have gotten into a great deal of trouble, psychologically as well as in their activities. but who are most of the time very interesting. Of course, I'd also been part of the Catholic worker community, where people who'd had all sorts of great difficulties were the people we were with all the time, coming in, serving food to, talking to, listening to, mostly, more than anything. So I suppose that I was particularly well prepared for prison. And once I knew that I wasn't actually being endangered by anybody, I could relax and just get to know the people, listen, and take the whole thing in. It was so fascinating. It was a great adventure. So I, you know, there were some awful moments, of course, and, but basically it was very nice. So it was such an exciting place to be.
Were you treated any differently?
Well, I suppose that there was. I mean, the more I was in prison and the older I got, the more I realized that they're always very nervous about anybody who can write. You see, and I'd been the managing editor of the Catholic Worker, and I was a journalist by this time. I was part of a newspaper staff. Well, this is immediately alarming to anybody who runs a prison. They don't like to have anybody around who can tell about these things. Not that there's all that much to tell about. Usually the prisons aren't corrupt, and there's not. But for some reason, wardens just in general tend to be very anxious and nervous about these kinds of people being in their care. But I wasn't conscious of that at that time. And maybe there was nothing to be conscious of, even, you know. It's a machine that absorbs in people for a time and tosses them back out again eventually. And if you enjoy listening to people, you've got a lot of people to listen to, and if you find stories interesting, well, there's no end of stories in prison. Not all of them true. Well, then, you often read stories that aren't true. We call them novels. So, I had about a month there. Mostly with black guys, mostly people who were drug addicts. Discovered many of them were poets, that there was an oral tradition of poetry in the American, in the New York City black community that was flourishing in this prison, Rikers Island, or Hearts Island, which was it? There are these two island prisons in the East River. Hearts Island.